John Ramirez is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Ramirez to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will air live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for a third of all U.S. executions in the modern era. Execution Watch host Marlo Blue, criminal defense attorneys Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, and Pat McCann, Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Linda Snyder, and special guest Clinton Young, a former death row convict and acquaintance with the condemned. The execution watch for John Ramirez begins.
Good evening and welcome to Execution Watch on this October the 5th, 2022. This is the show that airs on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, Texas, every time the state of Texas puts a condemned prisoner to death. Joining us here in the studio tonight is our chief legal analyst, Larry Douglas, our legal analyst, Mike Gillespie, and our guest, Pat McCann. Thank you guys for coming and joining us. We're also going to be airing an interview that we have with John Ramirez later on in the show. So please stay tuned for that. If you are tuning into KPFT 90.1 FM right now, hoping to hear What's Your Story with Harry Wojcik, please come back again next week when they'll be in full pledge drive mode. I know they have some very special shows for you. Right now, we have our reporter in front of the death house, Miss Linda Snyder. Linda, how are you tonight?
I'm doing good. Sad, but I'm all right. And they haven't come across yet, so no one's come across the line.
Now, this is someone who you actually know very well. Tell us a little bit about John, will you?
I know John very well. John is a nice man. He's truly sorry for what happened, and he just would have liked to have had a second chance, you know, where he could have spent the rest of his life in prison. That was one of the things he asked for, but that wasn't granted. And I have nothing ugly to say about the man, nothing.
Do we know if John has any invited witnesses today?
Well, I know his godmother is up there, but I'm not sure who else his witnesses are. I didn't ask him.
I should have asked him. I know his godmother, Jan Trujillo, has also brought Jan Ramirez's son. So I understand that. How long have you known John?
How long have I known him? Probably 8 years.
And you've spent a lot of time with him.
Yes, I have.
Have you heard anything from his attorneys or spiritual advisors or friends?
The spiritual advisor has been with him all day. And the friends that he has with him, they all just have nothing but nice things to say about him. And they hate that it's happening.
If you had to choose one thing that made John different from other people you've met on death row, could you tell me what that would be?
He was always smiling. He loved to eat. I mean, when you went to visit him, you spent the whole $25 because, I mean, he loved to eat.
Well, that can make a difference, I know. He's been on death row nearly 13 years, ever since his mid-20s. Does he ever talk about how he coped with doing time?
He told me, he said he just tries to, you know, he likes to draw, he likes to read. Likes to write. He loves to write. His letters were always very long. And, you know, he would tell about things on the road, what was going on. But, you know, he was just a good person.
You said they haven't come across. Do you mind explaining to our listeners who maybe this is the first time they've seen or heard a Texas execution, what that means?
Well, it means that once the reporters come across, and then after that, the witnesses cross the line and they go into the death chamber.
And when was your last visit with John?
My last visit was last Saturday night.
Any impressions or memories you want to share?
He just said that, you know, he felt like he was going to go, and he said he was ready, that, you know, if that's what God wanted, that was what he wanted. So that's basically all he said. We didn't talk a lot about it because it's kind of hard to talk about to someone about when they're dying. But, you know, he was okay with it. I mean, he didn't seem to be really bothered.
Well, it's hard to talk to somebody about death, especially their own, as it may be coming up. I get that. And you've been witnessed so many times.
Yes.
Your reporting is so important to our show. It really is. It's kind of the most, it's our linchpin, as it were. But it's got to be taking a toll. How do you cope with this kind of thing?
It's hard, you know, especially when it's somebody that you care about. It's very hard. And usually the next day I'm really sad. I just don't really like to talk a lot the next day, although tomorrow I'm going to visit a death row inmate because I'm down here, you know.
Right.
But
right.
I just, I don't know. I just, it's just hard.
Yeah. Can you describe the scene out there? It looks like there's quite a few people this time.
Yes, there is. And we're just trying to come across, but they have not yet.
Well, Linda, let us know, please. Let us know when they cross, and we will be in touch. Thank you very much. That was our reporter, Linda Snyder. And as we talk about this case, you know, one of the things that happens the most often is we lose sight of the humanity of people. There's the case, and then there's the person that they become in prison. And take us through that. Let's go with you, Larry. Tell me what's happened here.
Well, Marlo, there are a lot of people involved in this matter. John Henry Ramirez, who's 38 years old today, was 20 years old back in July of 2004 when he is reported to have killed Pablo Castro, who was about 46 years old then, by slicing and stabbing him 29 times in a convenience store. John grew up in a poor, somewhat rough neighborhood in Corpus Christi, got into a little bit of trouble, but went to school. I know went to at least to the 12th grade, might have even graduated. Went to the Marine Corps. And actually got through Marine Corps boot camp. So he is a Marine. Now, once he got through boot camp, when I talked to him, he really said he enjoyed boot camp. He couldn't stay out of trouble, primarily as it relates to drugs and alcohol. So as a result of his use of drugs and alcohol, he went AWOL, absent without leave, for, I think, 163 days. And so the Marine Corps discharged him on other than honorable discharge. And he just continued to, still a young man, in really good health then by having gone through Marine Corps boot camp. But he started using drugs pretty heavily in or around the Corpus Christi area. On this night, he was hanging out with a couple of young ladies. One of the young ladies' mother did not like the whole idea of him being at the house, so she put him out. The young lady sneaked him back in, and they put him out again. So they all went out to another friend's house to use drugs, and they ran out of money. So because they ran out of money, they decided to go and rob some people to take their money. So, strangely, they went out to rob several different people, none of whom had any money. The deceased, Pablo Castro, was working in a convenience store. He shows up at the convenience store. He and the manager talk about the fact that they would sometimes buy each other lunch. And so they work the evening shift, get in about 5 or 6 o'clock in the evening, and work until midnight. He tells the manager that, I don't have any money tonight, so could you pay for lunch? I've got a dollar. That's all I have. So he says, I've got you covered, because they went back and forth on that. And so he's working at the store. He's the primary cleanup guy. That the manager there who takes care of all the money and so forth. So he takes the trash out near closing time, and he's out just taking the trash out.
Let's go back to Linda Snyder for just a moment right now. Linda, do you have something to report?
Yes, the witnesses have now crossed the line and gone into the death chamber.
Thank you, Linda. Thank you very much. Please let us know when they come back out.
I sure will. Thank you.
I'm sorry.
As he's taking out the trash, the manager's sister comes over to bring them the dinner. She drops it and she says, "But by the way, there's somebody out there who's got a van parked right in the parking lot." So she says, "Okay, well." Then later, a couple of guys from the car wash across the street were noticing that there's a guy out there who's lying down. He's bleeding. So she calls 911, not knowing it's Pablo, because she thinks Pablo's still in the building. So she calls 911. She goes out there and she knows that that's Pablo out there. So the other guys were the witnesses said, that they kept her away from him. And so Ramirez and the two girls take off. And the Pablo Castro has been stabbed or sliced 29 times and he dies in a pool of blood. They've got blood all over them. They go to a convenience store to commit another robbery. They confront a woman who is in line waiting for her food on the drive-thru and put a knife to her throat. And she says, this knife that we're talking about is a jagged edge knife that Ramirez has been flashing all night long, showing everybody he's got this knife. So he puts the knife to her throat, what the evidence shows. And she says, "Don't do this in front of my baby." He curses her and says, "Give me your purse." He takes her purse and takes off. Then they go to rob somebody else in the line of a fast food restaurant. So he runs up to her window. She puts the knife toward her. She just leans back and closes the window. So he runs on the side and he starts banging on the window. She just backs up and takes off. That now there's an attempted robbery, and the police get behind him. And while when the murder of Pablo Castro is going on, the two guys at the car wash see a girl, a young lady, and a guy beating up an old guy. They think there's just a fight going on, and they look over and they see some striking motions, and one of the guys at the car wash says, "I recognize that guy. He went to school with me." Here in Corpus Christi. So the girls, when the officers get behind them, they manage to slip the officers, but they abandon the van in the woods and they're taken off running. The girls get caught, okay? And Ramirez gets away. And actually he gets away and he goes back to the house where they started out at, and there's one of the sisters is still in the house. She sees him come in. He's covered with blood, and he's got the knife, and he wants to wash up and stay there. She said, "No, you got to get out of here." So he leaves and he escapes to Mexico, and he's there for 3.5 years, and then he's caught in Brownsville, Texas. And so 3.5 years later, he stands trial for the capital murder. And these witnesses all come forward and testify against him. One of the girls had already pled and gotten 25 years. But again, when he comes back from Mexico, he gets arrested, and that's where the case starts off.
Well, and of course we have been here before, but as I understand, there were no more appeals. It was definitely going through. The witnesses have crossed from what they call the visitor center in Huntsville. And when we say they have crossed the road, it means that they have now walked into the witness gallery for the execution itself. There's been some There's been a lot of discussion about this particular case. What do you have to add?
The issue prior to this, when he had had a execution date set, was whether or not his pastor, Dana Moore, could be in the chamber with him and lay hands on him, as some folks do in their faith. And it became a matter of religious freedom for the Supreme Court and religious right for them to have a spiritual counselor at the last moments of their lives. Seth Kretzer, who took that case up and won it, is still his lawyer, and I know that he has fought diligently. There was a state law issue in this last round that was very important, but which we're not going to get answered. And it's because the, as Mike was asking earlier, the original DA who convicted has now retired. There was a new district attorney in Corpus in Nueces County, and that individual tried to withdraw their request for a death date. The judge who had issued the order would ask for briefing, but then decided against lifting it, and Seth took that up to the CCA. There was a parallel court case out of Harris County where a judge had refused to issue a death date and was threatened with a mandamus by the Harris County DA's office, a mandamus being an order from the court. And it looked like both of those things would head up and you would actually have a decision about the constitutional powers and the statutes at stake here, which is among these questions are whether a DA has the right to withdraw a requested death date and whether a judge has the right to get rid of it or stop it or let it go forward. She, after some argument and discussion, she changed her mind and then withdrew her prior order. So that case did not go up and has been reset. The case out of Corpus was rejected by the Court of Criminal Appeals. So there was no federal issue to take up. It was a matter of state law. And we don't have an answer right now. So parts of the stuff that are at stake here for the death penalty community and for citizenry are, what right does a DA have to change their mind on a death warrant? And what powers does a judge have to sign it, withdraw it, delay it? Those questions are going to remain unanswered for right now.
Mike?
There's not much I can add to what my fellow counselors have said. I'd like to talk a little bit about the original problem, which is freedom of religion. We've gotten confused between his rights and the rights that have always been there. And it seems like prisoners have always had the right to have ministers in Texas with them at their side and always had the right to lay their hands on them. It was never a problem until the federal government said that you have to open up to all religious beliefs at that time. And that's when Texas did not like that, because in their belief, there's one thing between being a Catholic priest and a Baptist minister and being a Muslim cleric who don't know what your qualifications are and they didn't want a bunch of strange people in the execution room. It's a legitimate issue. They resolve that issue by allowing anybody in as long as they're properly background checked and properly trained on how to handle it. The funny thing about it is the big argument was always there would be disruptions in the death chamber with all the tubes and needles and apparatus that it would be too disruptive. But in 573 executions with ministers there, there's never been disruption. But that gets to the other part of it. Do people have the right to be counseled at the time of their death? Now, I want to mention this to you because I had an interesting argument today with somebody I respect who says the victim didn't have a chance to be touched by a loved one, why should the condemned? Well, because we're Christians, because we have certain beliefs. But how do you deal with the mentality that says, punish people? This is not supposed to be about punishment. The truth of it, I believe the worst punishment is locking somebody in jail for the rest of his life with no hope of ever getting out. I've talked to too many people with life sentences, and that's what they dread the most, is never being able to leave. Executing them just becomes a way in order to end their lives. I do not think people understand how difficult life in prison is. I think the issue we're talking about, these courts are talking about, is basic human kindness, allowing somebody to be touched and prayed as they pass. What kind of society denies people who we are going to kill and execute the right to meet their maker in any way that they want to meet their maker? Is that not the purpose of the criminal system, to help people? And if at the end of their lives, they, and like this man, acknowledged what he did was wrong, didn't ask for any mercy, he was ready to die, why can't we let him die with dignity? And the dignity is being around somebody who we trust, who has laid his hands on him. And I'm a little bit confused. Was that minister on death row at one time? I thought I read
no. Dana Moore, I have no idea, but the Supreme Court has spoken to this now and said that it is proper to have a spiritual counselor at that time. And certainly, of all times, one wants one.
The fact we even got to even talk about this, you know, is kind of stunning to me, because we're not talking about anything more than a person coming to peace with the end of his own life because of his own sins. How can we as a society even deny a man the right to end his life the way he sees fit? Now, with that said, I think life in prison is a much harsher punishment.
Indeed. Well, Larry, of course, you did, you went to Livingston and got an interview with John Ramirez, and I believe we're going to go ahead and play that interview starting now, and we'll come back to you afterwards. Let's listen to the interview at this time. This is an uncut interview in its entirety.
John Ramirez? No, who are you? Okay, we're trying to let our audience know.
We've only got 20 minutes, so we ain't gonna be able to get through all that.
Well, we've got 20 minutes.
Right.
Just give it to us in a thumbnail. Who are you? Where are you from?
I'm from Corpus Christi, Texas.
Okay.
Born and raised most of my life. I spent a few years, some of my childhood in Houston, and then ended up going back to Corpus around 7, 8 years old, and you know. Your typical childhood, you know, living in the projects, government housing, stuff like that. I mean, where do you want me to start?
Anything that you want to say, the floor is yours. But you know, we're interested in your background, especially if there are any experiences you want to share with the public.
I want to talk about
the experience that you want to share with the public in terms of how it got you to where you are today.
I want to talk about where I'm at today. I want to talk about death penalty and Texas death row. That's what I want to talk about. You know,
that's
what I mean?
Left up to you.
Right.
Okay. So the Texas death penalty as it applies to John Ramirez.
Well, not just me. As it applies to everybody. You know, it's such a flawed system. It's literally our highest form of premeditated murder that we have in this, I guess, in this whole country, I guess you can call it, right? I mean, there's no other institution, there's no criminal that has ever done anything like that, where they just hold their victim, you know, against their will and at their mercy for so long, you know what I mean? And under all these oppressive type of, you know, just the way we are here, we're so oppressed, we're segregated, we have to eat crappy food, the mail's horrible, the visitation is horrible, you know, we can't even have contact, as you can see. You know, there's so much here that just needs to be, that I feel needs to be brought to attention. I mean, instead of concentrating on what's going to happen or why we got here. I mean, we got here because we made a mistake, you know what I mean? And if you know anything about my case, because I've done many, many interviews and whatnot and a lot of online stuff, I've never denied that I did kill a man, you know what I mean? What I deny is that I wasn't robbing him because there was no robbery. And the witnesses and my co-defendants, except for the one that eventually took a deal, you know, they attest to that as well. So, I mean, legally, I don't even apply for the death penalty. But, you know, I would like to talk about the death penalty. You know, let me ask you, since you're from Execution Watch and you got all this experience, what's your view on the death penalty? What's your stance?
Okay.
You for it? You against it? I mean,
personally, I do not believe that the state should be in the business of taking people's lives.
Right.
I don't even think death is a penalty.
We all have
a date.
Do you understand why? Do you understand why you feel that way?
Do I understand? Because it's wrong.
Right, right.
Okay, you know? It's wrong to take a life.
Right.
But I'm not here to talk about me. I'm here to talk about you.
Yeah,
so
but I mean,
let's just go back to your. You went to the Marine Corps, correct?
Right.
Okay. How was that?
Oh, it was great. I mean, it was awesome. It's the life. I mean, you can't get no better than that. You know.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, good pay, travel for free. It's such a good life, you know what I mean? I went straight out of high school to the Marines, you know? It's just, everything was good. You're exercising, you're in the best shape of your life. There's all types of life experiences, the discipline, the trade that you're learning, the people that you're around. And like I said, you get to travel. I went all over the place, and the pay is great. And if you're living on base, you pretty much don't have to spend much money. You know what I mean? They take care of everything for you. So, I mean, you're just accumulating money while you're serving your country. You know, so, I mean, what else would you like to know about it?
Well, I do want to thank you for your service, okay? We need people in the Corps. And you volunteered because it's a volunteer service now.
Well, the reason I did it is because, you know, just being from where I'm from, I was seeing all my friends. They were either getting strung out on dope or they were ended up in prison. Or some were even getting killed, you know? And so I was like, yeah, I got to do something. I can't just, I didn't want to go straight back into school, go right into college. Which is the only other choice. My only option was the military. You know what I mean?
Okay, tell me about high school. How'd you like that? You graduated, correct?
Of course, yeah. I mean, I loved high school, too. I mean, everything pretty much from middle school and up was just, you know, party central, you know, just having fun and chasing girls and doing the usual high school and middle school things, you know. You know, when you're young, you ain't got no worries. You ain't got no responsibilities. You ain't got, you know, life isn't. Reality ain't hitting you yet, so, you know, it was just fun. It was tough. I mean, of course, we all have our bad moments and whatnot, but I didn't really get in big trouble or anything, even though I was screwing up. I just never really, you know, got caught or got in trouble much, except for little regular PIs and stuff like that. And, you know, I got caught with a gun one time, but, you know, that was because I had just recently been shot, you know, been shot twice in the chest. So, I mean, you know, I was carrying a gun in case I ran into the same guy again. I'd be able to shoot before he shoot me, you know.
Now, when I was in high school, ROTC many, many years ago.
Oh, no, I didn't do none of that.
And there was this guy from the Marine Corps who came around talking to us about going to the Marines. And he was in the uniform, really impressive.
Right.
And a lot of guys got hooked on that. I started to go myself.
Right.
Okay, but I didn't. Okay, what caused you to go?
Well, like I said, I was either have to go to college or have to do something. I didn't really have a trade or a job back then, so I chose the military. And the way I did it is I was working for the Boys and Girls Club at that time, and I went ahead and had my employer look into all the recruiters and see which one was the best option. And so she brought a bunch of, like, videotapes and pamphlets and whatnot. And you could immediately tell that the Marine Corps was the hardest. Their boot camp is twice as long. Then you got to do another 3 months of combat training, which is extra compared to all the other services. And then you go to MOS school, and you could just tell right away that they had a higher standard. It was way more difficult than all the other branches. So me just being the stubborn little prideful teenager that I was like, yeah, that's the one I want. So that's the whole reason why I chose the Marine Corps. There was no other real reason other than that. Just, you know, pride, I guess.
So you decided to take the challenge.
Yeah, I decided to go for the hard one, you know what I mean?
See, I backed out. I didn't do that, okay? But you decided because you thought you could do it.
Oh, I knew I could do it. I mean, it wasn't, you know, there's people that I talk to, they pretty much tell you it's, you know, like boot camp and basic training. It's just a mind game. You know, they're just trying to break you down to build you back up. So as long as you can just endure the physical aspect, you're pretty much good to go. You know what I mean?
And you got through that?
Yeah, I got through that. We started off with like, I think 80-something recruits in my platoon, and we only graduated like 34.
How tall are you?
5'8".
And how much did you weigh coming out of high school?
About 180. 180. Yeah.
That was still pretty big. I mean, I was about 130 coming out of high school myself.
I
okay.
Like 180. I mean, I didn't even, you know, I was just skinny. I didn't really put on much weight. I just got real in shape. That was about it. I came out maybe 205, you know what I mean?
So you really bulked up some?
Yeah, just got more. You know, muscle weighs more than fat or whatever.
Right.
So that was pretty much it. It wasn't much of a difference. I just, like I said, just got real fit and sculpted. That's it.
Graduated high school, mm-hmm. took the challenge to go to the Marine Corps,
yep.
Completed boot
yep.
camp,
yeah.
and you were a soldier, a
I
Marine.
I was a Marine.
Marine. Oh,
I
you
was
are,
a Marine.
You are a Marine.
I was a Marine,
I'm told,
right.
Once a Marine, always a Marine.
Right, that's right.
So
that's
you
right.
are a Marine.
Right.
Okay. And then after the Marine Corps, what? Tell us about yourself.
Well, I ended up getting in trouble in the Marine Corps, too, while I was stationed in Honolulu, Hawaii, and I got discharged. You know, they basically said I was crazy. They gave me this mental eval that said, I don't know, diagnosed with me like four different things, said I was crazy and discharged me under that. Really, I should have been discharged for other reasons because I was fighting one of my superiors, but, you know, my colonel, I guess he kind of helped me out by giving me a medical discharge because I could rejoin 7 years later. And sure enough, as soon as I got back home, I just got right back into the same old lifestyle, kicking it with the same friends, doing the same thing, getting back into, you know, getting high all the time and drinking and partying. And, you know, I think I got home March 2004, and then in July, I caught this case.
Now, how long were you in the Marine Corps?
Since 02 to 04.
Okay, okay.
02 to 04, yeah.
And where'd you go? You say you're talking about Honolulu, Hawaii. Where else?
California. I went to three different places in California, and then I got stationed in Honolulu, and that was the last place I was at.
Okay, okay, okay.
I requested Japan, but they didn't give it to me. They gave me Hawaii. That was my second choice, so, you know.
Okay. Then you get back home, or did you get a job or anything of that sort?
I don't remember what I was doing when I got back home. Like I said, I was only there a few months. I got back right in the middle of spring break, and so it was just right back to Party Central, and that was it. By July, I caught this case and went to Mexico, and I was in Mexico for 4 years on the run.
Okay, now what's how did that whole happen, going to Mexico for the 4 years?
Well, I woke up the day after the crime was committed, and I saw myself all over the news that they were having a manhunt for me and everything. So I was like, okay, I got to get somewhere. You know what I mean? I'm not going to turn myself in. And so the first thing I did was I fled. I mean, what else was I supposed to do? And I had a friend drive me to Brownsville, and I crossed the border, and there were some other friends over there from the same neighborhood that were already in Mexico wanted for some murders as well. And I just lived with them for a little while until I was able to accumulate some money and start my own little life over there.
Your life in Mexico. So yeah. This is 4 years in Mexico. That was pretty good life?
Yeah, it was a great life. I mean, everything over there, if I would have known it was like that, I would have went over there a long time ago.
Tell us about it.
I mean, it's just the cost of living is so cheap. The food is awesome. The people are great. You know, the whole criminal aspect over there is just wide open because everything, you know, the police are the cartel members, you know what I mean? They are the members of the cartel. They run everything, so everything's so corrupt. As long as you got someone that you're in with, you pretty much got a green light to just do whatever you want over there. It doesn't mean there's really no law over there. You just do whatever you want. It's so just wide open. So basically, I never had to worry about getting caught. I never had to worry about getting arrested, getting extradited. I didn't have to worry about any of that. You know, what ended up happening is my very own friends ended up making a deal with the FBI, and then they're the ones that turned me in, you know what I mean?
You thought he was your friend, huh?
Yeah, my very own homeboys, you know what I mean? But they dropped his case, and he was able to go back home. So, you know, I guess it was worth it for him, right?
Tell us about growing up. I mean, tell us about your family and all.
Like I said, I don't want to do the same old song and dance. Yeah, I had a bad childhood, but a lot of people have bad childhoods, and they don't end up on death row, you know what I mean?
Okay.
So, I mean, I don't really want to harp on that and do the pity party thing. That's not really my thing. But, I mean, if you have some specific questions, you can ask me a specific question. What do you want to know?
I'm just opening it up for you, man. Just opening up.
You know, just typical childhood, you know, poor, living in the ghetto, living off of food stamps and welfare. You know, just typical childhood. Living in projects most of my life and growing up and having to deal with gangs and all that stuff and violence and fighting and just, you know, just typical poor person childhood. I mean, you hear this story 1,000 times, you know, but like I said, not everyone ends up here. Not everyone ends up killing people. Not everyone ends up, you know, going to the military and then getting kicked out. So, I mean, I don't really want to seem like I'm trying to do that pity party thing, you know.
And I don't want you to talk about anything you don't want to talk
about.
Right. Okay. What I want you to talk about is anything that you think that people might want to hear from you.
Well, I mean, like I said, I want to talk about the death penalty, you know, how crazy this whole institution is. It's just, it's so wild to me, you know, that our own governments are murdering us, and they label it as justice. They dress it up as, you know, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And if they even have any biblical knowledge whatsoever, they know that they're twisting that whole concept, you know, they're twisting it and using it totally wrong, you know.
So the biblical reference to eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth.
Yeah, you notice they never mentioned that talking about when animals were accidentally let free and accidentally killed someone. And not only that, when they were talking about a person killing someone, they made 7 sanctuary cities where they allow you to flee for 7 years. And if you didn't screw up in those 7 years, then you were redeemed and you can go back into the regular society and live and whatnot, you know. But you don't ever hear them talk about that because that doesn't fit their agenda, you know. Most of these politicians don't even know what they're talking about. Not only that, but because this system is so flawed, look at all the people that have been proven innocent once they've already been killed. Look at all the people that have been exonerated once they've been here. It's such a flawed system. If even one innocent person ends up getting killed because of this, then you can't do this. This is a failed system. You can't do this. You have to do something else. Give them life imprisonment. And, you know, looking at it on another stance, like me myself, I consider if I do get killed, I don't want to get killed. I'm not going to help them kill me. I'm not going to help my own government murder me. But if it does happen, you know, it's like a double-edged sword because on the one hand, I get to get out of here. You know, I get to get free from all this. You know, my struggle is over. All this oppression, it's done. My wages are paid for, you know, like the Bible says. And, you know, at the same time, I don't want to go. And considering like a life sentence, which would be the other option, you got to think, now that's a punishment. For them to imprison you for the rest of your natural life, it's just another death sentence because you're going to die of old age. Now that's a real punishment. If they really wanted to punish us for something, that is a punishment. You have no hope of ever getting out. You're going to live the rest of your days and the rest of your natural life in this type of place, in this oppression, having to deal with all these things that I listed earlier for the rest of your natural life. Now that's a punishment. You know, sitting here for an average of a decade, you know, 10 years and then being murdered, yeah, that's pretty harsh too, but I mean, that's nothing compared to a life sentence. If you think about it, you know, the reality of it, the timetable, the struggle, the pain, the suffering, the depression, the sadness. I mean, there's so many aspects that they don't take into account. You know what I mean? And that's not even going back to, like I said, I don't even legally qualify for the death penalty, but yet they're still going to kill me.
Okay, let's talk about that, because it's clear that you've clearly read the law on your case.
Yeah, I've done a lot of studying of the law. You know what I mean? I've helped my lawyers on the last 2 stays that I've gotten. You know, the last one was a full withdrawal. You know, I hope to help them on this one, too, but it doesn't look too good so far.
Okay. And you're saying that your case should not have been classified as a death penalty case because?
Because it's not. There was no robbery. There was no capital offense, you know, that turned it to a capital. You know what I mean? I've said that from the get-go. And my 2 co-defendants said the same thing up until 2 years later when they finally accepted a deal. Then they changed their tune and both wrote identical statements, like literally word for word, verbatim, identical. Which, how does that happen? You know what I mean? And the 2 witnesses, they saw the whole fight. Because, like I said, it was just a fight where I just went a little way too far. You know, I could just lost it. And I realized I went too far once I saw how badly injured he was. And that's, you know, even the witness will tell you, you know, they were sitting there fighting. And they didn't even know I had a knife. You know, and they're saying that I was punching him. And they say once he fell down his knees, I just stood there and looked at him. And I just stared at him for a while. And I walked away. I walked away, got in the truck, and drove off. You know what I mean? And which is exactly what I said, you know, exactly what I said. I noticed it. That I had cut him in the throat. I noticed that he was bleeding, you know, profusely. I knew he was out of there. Just looking at him, I knew he was out of there. You know, and if you look at the autopsy, I had just got fresh out of the Marines. Everything in boot camp, everything in combat training is kill, kill. Everything they teach you, they train you to kill someone in the fastest way possible. 1 shot, 1 kill. And if you look at the autopsy, all those wounds, every single one of them was a fatal wound. except for the 10 that he had on his hands where he kept trying to grab the knife, the defensive wound. But all the other ones on his body, every single one of them just by itself would have killed him. You know what I mean? And they don't take none of that into account. I was trained for that. I was fresh out of the military just being trained all this stuff, practicing this stuff. I was a green belt in MCMAT, Marine Corps Martial Arts. That's a third belt out of five where they teach us just to kill your opponent in the quickest way possible. One shot, one kill. And none of this gets taken into account in my trial. None of it gets to get brought up. None of this. I mean, it's just they're holding me on a trial where my jury is supposed to be my peers, but none of them are my peers. Not one single one of those 14, counting the two alternates, grew up like I grew up, lived where I lived, did the things I did, you know, experienced things I experienced. So how are they my peers? Not one single one of them is military, you know what I mean? Not one single one of them was Marine or went through all that training. And there's just so many aspects of this whole system that is so flawed and so just screwed up. You know what I mean? And it's, you know, I'd asked you earlier, like, what is your stance on the death penalty? Because I had stopped listening to Execution Watch years ago because y'all had a certain person on there. I can't remember who it was. And I always thought y'all were anti-death penalty, but that guy was like always making weird statements and weird comments where he was like, he wasn't really anti-death penalty. I don't know how to explain it, right? You know, and then like one of the things that y'all say regularly when y'all talk about the case facts and what happened in trial is y'all speak about these things like they're facts. When you're a lawyer, right? Are
yes.
you a lawyer?
Yes.
Okay, so you know that in every lawyer that I know, that there's a defense lawyer or even a prosecutor, y'all know that there's so much BS that gets said in the trial. There's so much lie and just blatant falsehoods that get said and get. I mean, that's the whole thing of a trial. It's litigation. Who can litigate and argue it better? And that you're literally lying. You know that's part of y'all's job. And yet y'all speak about these things like when y'all comment, oh well, he did. excuse me. He did this or he did that, as if that is a pure fact. Y'all don't even entertain that maybe that might be wrong, or maybe they're just saying that, and the defendant, you know, whoever it is at that time, like being me in this case, just wasn't allowed to speak. I tried speaking in my trial, and I got shut off by the judge. He told me if I spoke again that he was going to kick me out and have me view the whole trial through a monitor because I tried to speak up because my lawyers wouldn't speak. My lawyers wouldn't say what I want them to say and do what I want them to do. You know, that's why, if you know anything about my trial, when we got to the punishment phase, that's why after they put my dad up there and they just basically trashed him, even though I don't even like my dad. I didn't even grow up with my dad. There's no love lost between me and him. But they're not going to put my family up there and just smash him and play the pity party and try to get all that sympathy vote when they're not even doing their job like I asked them to do. You know what I mean? So that's why I made the decision to not put no mitigation evidence. Not because I was trying to get the death penalty, or I was trying to get killed, or I was on some type of weird suicidal, you know, thing. No, it was nothing like that. But like I said, this is all things that y'all don't know about, you know, and that y'all don't ever speak on when y'all do the show. That's why it was one of the first things I asked you, what's your stance on it? Because, you know, those are things that are very important to this whole show, to this whole issue of being on death row and being in the death penalty. And, you know, I don't ever hear nobody talk about that. I always hear people talk about their background and whatnot, and that's fine, but you can find all that on the internet. You can find all that in our case. You know, I want to talk about the death penalty. That's why I was like, you know, that's why I started the conversation with that. Because this place is so screwed up, man. This place is so messed up. This whole institution is just, it's a big joke. And the end of this joke is they're murdering people, you know what I mean? And it's just crazy to me. I mean, like you said yourself, it's wrong. It's wrong. And if I can speak out against it, I get like this avenue here where I can talk. And if I end up getting murdered too, and then y'all get to play it, I mean, hopefully I'll say something that will help someone, you know, take action or stand up, do something, you know.
How old are you now?
I'm 36.
36. So you could conceivably live several more decades.
I'm perfectly healthy. I mean, I'm a little on the chunky side, but other than that, I mean, I'm perfectly healthy. Other than being executed by lethal injection, I'll probably live a long, long life, even in prison, you know what I mean?
And you would prefer that?
Like I said, it's like a double-edged sword. Yes and no. I mean, like I said, it's just another death penalty. You know, I'm kind of, I can see both ends of it because I've thought about it so much, so I'm not, first of all, I'm not going to help my government murder me.
Okay.
So, automatically, then yes, if they gave me the option, then yeah, I would take it. But at the same time, I don't want to live the rest of my life in prison. I will. If that's the only option. You know what I mean? I will. I get to see my son's boy. He's 15 now. You know, I got arrested when he was 2 years old. He's bigger than me. He's a big old monster. You know, I used to call him my mini-me. Now I'm calling him my mini-Shrek because he's so big. You know what I mean? I don't know what they're feeding him. But I would love to see him grow into a man. I would love to see his first, like, serious relationship. I would love to become a granddad, you know, and see my grandchildren and whatnot. You know, it's just, you know, Texas just doesn't want to let me do that. You know what I mean? And it's so crazy because I'm one of the few people that actually, you know, has taken responsibility for the crime. I mean, of course, after they captured me, of course I ran. I mean, who's not going to run something like that? You know what I mean? But I'm one of the few people that actually take responsibility for the death that was caused by my hand, and it's not getting me nothing. You know what I mean? I don't get no credit. I don't get nothing for that. I might as well sit here and do like everyone else and just completely deny it. You know what I mean?
You were giving us a little advice earlier about what we should be doing on the show, mm-hmm. in terms of, tell me what you would advise us to do.
I'm basically talking about the way y'all speak about the case facts. When y'all start talking about the cases, you know, y'all start to show up and y'all start talking, okay, Texas is going to have its way, blah, blah, blah. And y'all start talking about the cases. Oh, Ramirez, he was whatever for robberies and murder and this and that. He was robbing Pablo Castro and blah, blah. You know, y'all say things in such a way, like, from my point of view, and I know other people feel the same way.
Testing 1, 2, 3.
Same thing about mic. Execution cool. Watch. Mic. And mic. Especially when that old guy used to be there. He's not there no more. I don't know who he is. I don't remember his name or whatever. But he would always be real.
Hi, Michael. How you doing this evening?
Say things that were real, like, demeaning and damning toward the person that you're doing the show about. You know what I mean? And, Ward, what was that guy's, Adam Ward, I believe, man, he like outright just downed the dude's family and talked about the dude's family was dirty and they had a house that was all, and they were hoarders, and it's like, that's not necessary. I mean, this show's not about that. The show's about the death penalty and what the state is doing. And, you know, if you wanted my advice, I would say talk about the death penalty. The death penalty is wrong. You know what I mean? They're about to just murder this man. You know what I mean? Like, every time I talk about it, I use the word murder. I don't use the word execution. I use the word murder, you know, because that's what they're doing. They're murdering you. You know, this is the definition of murder, and it's the highest form of premeditated murder that you're going to find in this whole country. You know what I mean? There's so many aspects of this death penalty that is so wrong that they can open people's minds to a different train of thought. Like, if you're going to take my biggest mistake, which is taking someone's life, and hold me to that one mistake, say, this is who I am. You know, your name is
My name is Larry Douglas.
Larry Douglas, okay. What? Think of the worst thing you've ever did in your life. Now, imagine if everybody, your whole society, your family, and everybody treated you according to that mistake for the rest of your natural life. That's not right. I mean, if you're going to do that, why don't you pick my greatest accomplishment? You know what I mean? I created a life, too. Why don't you pick that and judge me on that and hold me to that standard for the rest of my life? No, you want to pick the worst thing that I have done. You know what I mean? I read a quote by, Ezra Pound, where he says, there's no reason why a man should like the same book at the age of 18 that he would like at the age of 48. Exactly. I'm not the same person I was when I did take that life. And I can tell you myself, I was pretty screwed up. You know, I was pretty selfish. I was a terrible person. Really, I really was. I didn't care about nobody. I mean, that's the only reason why something like that could happen, where I could just stab a person that many times so carelessly and not even think about what could possibly happen, that he could possibly die. I can be so drugged up on pills and alcohol and weed and cocaine and, you know what I mean, and not really care about how I'm affecting those around me. I know that. I see that. But I'm a totally different person now. You know what I mean? The person that they're going to execute on September 8th, if it goes down, that's not the same person that committed that crime. You know what I mean? So... there's just so much. There's so much content here. Okay,
we're about done now. We've run just about out of time. But you give good advice. And so as we close, I was just wondering, you know, at your age right now, if you had to give some advice to the 15, 20-year-old John Ramirez, what would that advice be?
I don't know. Read a book. Learn, you know, educate yourself. You know what I mean? I've done a lot of educating since I've been in here, you know, a lot of just expanding my knowledge and my mind, and just, you know, I just know a lot more than I did back then. I think that's the reason I was just so messed up back then. I was just so ignorant,
And is there anything else you'd like to say before we...
Anyone that's listening that doesn't advocate or that could advocate or has a venue, has an outlet, just keep fighting this. Eventually they're going to do away with this, eventually. But, the more people that fight it, the faster it'll be gone,
I think you're right about that. Eventually will be...
Yeah, eventually.
We'll
Everything changes.
Right.
It's a cycle of life. So eventually they're going to do away with this, especially as more and more states do away with it. Eventually Texas is going to have to, get in line too.
Yeah.
But, it always helps. The more voices we have, make some noise. Don't be afraid to be heard.
We appreciate your voice.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care now.
All right.
Bye.
That was an interview with Larry Douglas and John Ramirez. At this point, let's go ahead and go back to Huntsville with Linda Snyder. Linda.
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, Linda.
Hi.
Tell us what's happened.
The family just came across, and I guess they're getting in their car to go to the chapel now. But it's over. Unfortunately, it's over.
For our listeners who have not experienced this before, when she says that the witnesses have come back across the road and gotten in their car to go to the chapel, this is the first time that so many of the family have actually had an opportunity to touch their loved ones since their incarceration. It's a very important moment in this process. But if you're just joining us now, John Ramirez is dead in Huntsville. Let's bring it back here into the studio with Larry Douglas, Pat McCann, and Mike Gillespie. Gentlemen, so many things happened in this. I was told by John's godmother, Jan Trujillo, that religion really had become his cornerstone, the most important thing in his life in the very end. But how did that react to the John Ramirez that you met and interviewed?
It makes sense, okay? But the other thing is, that's a critical issue for everybody in terms of preparing to leave the earth. Everybody, a friend of mine was talking about being a chaplain at the hospital. And he was chaplain through the Methodist. And he's a Baptist. I'm saying, how can you be a chaplain at the Methodist when you're Baptist? He says, you don't have to be a Methodist to be a chaplain at the Methodist. In fact, you don't have to have any religion. You can be an atheist and still be a chaplain, because when we make that transition, we all need someone to be there with us. If we can have someone, we'd like to have someone to be there with us. And that's critical for all of us. And I think that's something that shouldn't be denied anybody by the state.
Pat?
The irony of this case is that Mr. Ramirez will be remembered for an issue of religious freedom, and Mr. Castro will not be. And that's the odd strangeness of the death penalty here in Texas, which is that people get a chance to be a symbol or a spokesperson for an issue that actually has constitutional importance. And tragically for the family of Mr. Castro, while they may feel closure, their father will not be remembered in the same way. And regardless of the fairness of that, that's the truth. John Paul Penry will be remembered for the proposition that we don't kill the intellectually disabled, as Mr. Atkins will be, that those are reasons for mercy. And in this case, Mr. Ramirez will be remembered for a stance on religious freedom that actually shows the heart of the Supreme Court on this case. And perhaps that's an issue that death penalty lawyers should look at hard in their preparations for trial, their motions, and their ability to keep people with religious views on a jury that decides life or death. none of this makes any sense at the end of the day. And at the end of the day, Mr. Ramirez is gone. And there was not much to be done legally for him at that point. And that is a comment on how our death penalty is working or not working these days.
But hasn't Mr. Ramirez died and left for mankind the concept of sorrow and forgiveness? Is not the only excuse for executing people is the fact that society learns from that? He'll be remembered because he said things to regret his life. He regret things that he did. How do we know how that's going to affect some kid out there?
I hope it does, and I hope your point's well
isn't
taken.
Isn't that why we're supposed to be? If we're not doing it for that reason, then we shouldn't be doing this at all. And I don't think we should be doing it at all, to be honest with you. But I thought he died in a way that was responsible, taking responsibility for what he did, accepting his fate and his punishment, and went to meet his maker. The fact that he could believe in a maker should be enough to make other people believe in other things, like there is life after death, that there is something more to this world than just being alive over here. That's the message he gave, and he gave it with his own life. Now, I can't say anything bad about the man he killed. It's a horrible scenario.
Well, gentlemen, it is time for us to wrap up Execution Watch for today. Thank you very much for your contributions. Thanks for being a part of this. It is time. If our next execution here in Texas is scheduled for November 9th, when Texas plans to usher Tracy Beatty into the death chamber in Huntsville, Texas. If it does, Execution Watch will cover the state-sanctioned killing live. We do welcome your opinions on social media and beyond. And to learn more about the death penalty and executions in the state of Texas, you can find us on Facebook at Execution Watch or online at executionwatch.org. We can also get on our mailing list for all our latest updates. Thank you to our guests, Pat McCann, our panel, Larry Douglas and Mike Gillespie, Death House reporter Linda Snyder, executive producer Elizabeth Stein, KPFT and Pacifica executive producer and technical advisor Otis McClay, and Houston Media Source technical producer Mark Pirtle. For those listening live on KPFT 90.1 FM, stay tuned for Living Art with Michael Woodson. On behalf of Execution Watch crew, I'm Marlo Blue. Good night.